Hello, I'm Carl Opedal, and I will be talking to you about the basic procedures of the United States patent system. I'll be talking with you about the sequences of events that take place as somebody applies for and hopefully gets a U.S. patent. During this series of lectures, I will be talking about each of the individual steps one by one in great detail. From time to time, I will turn back and review some of the things we talked about previously, and by the end, hopefully you will feel that you have learned something about the patent system in the United States, the system of applying for and getting a patent. Let's first talk about a patent application. The patent application is an important document. The patent application has several parts that we will talk about, and you might wonder if you wanted to see a patent application, if you wanted to see several different patent applications, if you wanted to try to learn something about what are the contents of a patent application. It may be interesting to you to hear that one of the ways you can find this out is by looking at some granted U.S. patents. Take any one granted U.S. patent, and basically what you are seeing is a neatly typeset, neatly printed version of the patent application that was filed in the first place. So if you would like to see a patent application, just go find a granted patent and sit and read that. When I say this, I'm oversimplifying a little bit. The differences between a filed patent application and a granted U.S. patent, the differences can include differences in the claims. It is very commonplace that between the time when a patent application is filed on the one hand and when the patent is granted, the language of the claims will have changed perhaps several times as a consequence of negotiation between the patent applicant and the patent examiner. This negotiation can involve some back and forth communications, and eventually the patent applicant and the patent examiner may reach agreement that such and such claim language is acceptable to both sides. When that time comes, the patent application is allowed, and then after that, the patent is granted. The granted U.S. patent is thus largely the same as the original patent application, but may be different, for example, in the claims. Some other things can change as well. Occasionally, the wording of other parts of the patent application may change somewhat as a result of agreements reached between the applicant and the examiner, although most often, the rest of the patent application, the parts other than the claims, will remain very nearly unchanged during the process, and in almost every case will appear in the granted patent identical or nearly identical to the language that was filed when the patent application was filed in the first place. The granted patent will also contain a few other things beyond what was in the original patent application, and we will talk about those later. Okay, so what are some of the parts of a patent application? I've just mentioned what are called the claims. The claims define that which the applicant thinks they invented. The claims define that which the applicant hopes they will someday be able to exclude other people from doing if and when the patent is granted. The rest of the patent application will include what is called a specification or a description. The specification is often referred to by its nickname, the spec. So the spec and the claims are two parts of the patent application that we have just mentioned. The spec is required to contain enablement. It is required to contain sufficient information to enable someone skilled in the art to practice the invention. If you've invented a better mousetrap, the spec has to explain how to build one of these mousetraps. If you've invented a better way to use a mousetrap, the spec has to explain how to use the mousetrap. If you've invented a new chemical, say a therapeutic substance used to treat a particular disease, well, you have to explain how to synthesize that chemical. If you've come up with a better kind of roofing tile to go on the top of a house or a building, you have to explain how to make that roofing tile. How far back does that have to go? If it's a roofing tile, do you have to explain how to go find the clay and mix up the clay and mix it with water and put it in an oven and bake it until it has become the clay of the roofing tile? Maybe not. Maybe not, because U.S. patent law says that you have to enable someone skilled in the relevant art to practice the invention. So, if the relevant art is the world of making roofing tiles, you can assume that the reader knows the things that anybody would know who knows how to make roofing tiles generally. Similarly, if you are patenting, say, a therapeutic substance, a new drug, you are allowed to assume that the reader is a person of person of ordinary skill in the art of making pharmaceutical drugs in that particular field. So you might not have to explain everything about how to synthesize it, because maybe you can make some assumptions about people of ordinary skill in the relevant art. What else does the spec have to communicate? Under U.S. law, the spec must communicate the best mode known to the applicant for practicing the invention. This means that if you know two or three different ways to make your better mousetrap, and if you know that one of those ways is better than the others, you need to make sure that that particular one is revealed in the spec. It means that if you, not only if you know, but even if it's just your opinion, if your opinion is that one of them is better than the others, you better reveal that one. The spec is also required to contain a written description of what you think you invented, or what the inventor thinks they invented. The written description requirement is an interesting one, and we'll talk about it a little bit, but on that topic, as on many of the other topics we will talk about, I should say that although we will touch on a topic and talk about it a little bit, many of these topics could cover a lecture of an hour or 2 hours all by itself. It would be easy to spend an hour or even 2 hours, for example, talking about the written description requirement. But for the moment, I will just mention that U.S. patent law requires that the patent application contain a written description of that which the inventor feels they invented. Most patent applications also contain drawings. Not every patent application contains drawings. A typical example of a type of patent application that might not contain any drawings is a patent application directed to a composition of matter. For example, a new chemical, a new drug, a new molecule, a new kind of paint, a new kind of glue. It might turn out that you don't need any drawings to explain about your invention if it's in one of those categories. It might turn out that you don't need any figures to say how to synthesize this new chemical, or how to mix up this kind of glue, or how to make this kind of paint. Maybe no figures would be needed. But the majority of patent applications filed in the U.S. Patent Office have drawings. And the reason for that is probably twofold. First, most inventions really do benefit from drawings. People say a picture is worth 1,000 words, and of course they're right when they say that. The situation is that most people learn well, most people learn quickly, if the information available to them is not only words but also drawings, figures. So that's one reason. And a second reason, I think, is simply that somebody who's writing a patent application is influenced by what they see around them. They see that almost all the other patent applications they ever saw had drawings in them, and that will make people think, well, I better put in some drawings as well. A patent application will typically also contain what is called an abstract, limited to 150 words or so. The abstract is a requirement for a full patent application, and the abstract is mostly of historical, almost archaeological interest. Many, many years ago, people who would study granted patents, people who would do searching to see what had been patented before, would search the actual physical patents. And the actual physical patent would have an abstract on the front page, and it would have one of the figures on the front page. Somebody who was searching to look through granted patents to see what had already been patented and what had not would make quick reference to the abstract and would look quickly at the figure that was on the front page of the patent as part of a very quick review process in an effort to figure out which patents were not interesting and which patents would deserve further study. That's in the old days. Nowadays, nobody searches patents that way. People who search patents, who look through old patents to see what has already been patented, they do it electronically. They go to a keyboard, they type in the words that are interesting to them, keywords, maybe they use some numerical classification system to pick out particular patents that have been classified in particular technological areas. That kind of searching, computerized searching, can search for words located anywhere in a patent. Words might be in the spec, the words might be in the claims. Yes, the words might be in the abstract. But there's nothing special about the abstract that it would make a big difference when somebody is doing computer searching. But in the old days, when people did searching on paper, it was really important that the front page of the patent contain enough information to let somebody make a very quick decision whether to study a particular patent in detail or whether to skip over that one and go look at the next one in line. So in the old days, the abstract really mattered. Nowadays, the abstract doesn't matter at all. For me, in my own patent practice, it means that I do not spend a lot of time or energy thinking about what will go into the abstract. I write an abstract. As I will mention later in a future lecture, a lot of times the abstract that I write will be identical to the section that is called Summary of the Invention, which we will also talk about. But I don't spend a lot of time or energy on the abstract. This doesn't change the fact that the U.S. patent rules require that a patent application contain an abstract. The patent application also has to have a title. The patent application will also have other things with it when it's filed, and we will talk about those in a moment. One of the first things that a person will come to know as they start doing patent law, as they start representing inventors before the patent office, one of the first things that somebody will come to know is that there is a sort of a checklist of things that you would like to have in your patent application, in your package, when you file it with the patent office. And I will now draw a distinction between two different lists. One list is the list of things that absolutely must be there, and if any one of them is missing, then it will turn out that even though you may think you filed a patent application, you did not actually file a patent application. Call this the short list, if you will. The short list is the things that simply must be there, and if you overlook it, if you leave it out, you have not accomplished your goal. You have not really filed a patent application. The U.S. Patent Office uses a kind of a peculiar terminology to communicate what they mean when they say that you either have filed a patent application or you have not. The terminology they use at the Patent Office is that you either obtained a filing date or you did not obtain a filing date. You have obtained a filing date if what you filed was everything on the short list. If, on the other hand, it turns out you screwed up, you made a mistake, you overlooked something, you left out something on the short list, then the terminology that the U.S. Patent Office will use is that you did not obtain a filing date. So, we will talk about what is the short list, and then we will talk about a longer list. But first, the short list. What is the absolute bare minimum of what would need to be in the envelope that you send to the Patent Office so that you get a filing date. Well, for an ordinary U.S. patent application, the requirements are as follows. First, at least one claim. We've mentioned claims before. Now you can see claims must be important because you have to have at least one of them to get a filing date. What else? Well, there must be a spec, a specification. There must be drawings, except that it's not true that there must be drawings. What an odd thing that the short list either does or does not include drawings. But as I mentioned earlier, for some categories of invention, some types of technology, drawings are not needed. Chemical substances, compositions of matter, those are examples of areas where you would not need even one drawing to get a filing date. But for most kinds of invention, most technology areas, you will not get a filing date unless you provided sufficient drawings to explain your invention. Backing up and talking again about the spec. To get a filing date, that spec cannot simply be 100 randomly chosen words out of the dictionary. You can't simply clip something out of a newspaper and throw it in an envelope and say, this is a patent specification. No. The specification, as I mentioned earlier, must provide enablement. It must enable someone skilled in the art to practice the invention. The specification must contain the best mode known to the applicant for practicing the invention. The specification must contain a written description of what the inventor thinks they invented. If the spec was missing any one of those things, then it will turn out that you did not get a filing date. It will turn out that you did not really file a patent application. These burdens, the burdens of whether you did or did not provide enablement, whether you did or did not disclose the best mode, whether you did or did not provide written description, are burdens that are tied to whatever it is that is being claimed. Now, this may sound a bit odd, but let me make up one or two examples to try to illustrate how it is that the choice of the claims will in turn determine what counts as a good enough specification or an inadequate specification for purposes of getting a filing date. Suppose the inventor invented three things, call them A, B, and C, and we are thinking that we might write a patent application directed to all three of these things, A, B, and C. A might be a better kind of paint, B might be a better kind of paint that's a certain color, C might be a better kind of paint that's a certain color, and it has some other nice property like being scuff resistant or something. But anyway, suppose there are three perhaps related but not identical things, three things that the inventor sort of hopes they can cover with their patent, A, B, and C. Well, if you draft claims to all of A, B, and C and put them into your patent application, then later when somebody evaluates your specification to see whether it was good enough or whether it was inadequate, they will evaluate it as to each of those three things, A, B, or C. Suppose it turns out, you wouldn't like this to happen, but maybe it happens, that in the spec you failed to provide a written description of C. And let's say you also failed to provide the best mode for C. Well, then it will later turn out that you did not obtain a filing date as to invention C. That if you try to get a patent that contains the claims to invention C, you will fail because the patent examiner will catch you and will say, yeah, you were trying to patent C, but you didn't provide written description, you didn't provide best mode, so I'm afraid you're not entitled to a patent on this patent application with respect to invention C. Maybe that would be the bad news for invention C. But meanwhile, maybe it turns out you did do a good enough job as to inventions A and B. You did provide written description, you did provide the best mode, you did provide enablement. Well, then it will turn out you did obtain a filing date with respect to A and B, and those inventions are the ones for which, when good luck smiles upon you, you'll receive a granted patent. What I'm trying to emphasize here is that the evaluation of a patent application to see whether it did or did not contain everything that was needed to get a filing date is an evaluation that is specific to particular claimed inventions, and that it's not all or nothing. It's not that the whole patent application is defective or the whole patent application is good enough. It is that unless you figure out which invention or inventions you're talking about, you wouldn't be able to say whether you did or did not get a filing date, whether you did or did not include everything in the patent application that needed to be there. People who file patent applications regularly, people who represent inventors often, filing patent applications before the U.S. Patent Office, they get into a rhythm. They get to where they're accustomed to these worries. Whenever they're preparing a patent application, they will constantly be thinking, what is the invention? Or if there's more than one, what are the inventions? They'll be thinking, I'm going to try to draft a good claim. They will be thinking, I'm going to have to put the best mode into my patent application. They'll be thinking, I have to put enablement into my patent application. They'll be thinking, I better provide figures. I better provide written description. And from time to time in somebody's career, they will file yet another patent application. It might be once a month. It might be once a week. Maybe it's more often than that, depending on the workload and the technology areas involved. But they'll be thinking of these things. And when the time comes to file the patent application, the person who's representing the inventor, the patent agent, or the patent attorney will be thinking about these things, and they will say, do I have the short list? Have I provided everything on the short list? And then they file the patent application. And hopefully, it always turns out that what was filed was in compliance with the short list. Hopefully, it turns out that it was enough to be entitled to a filing date before the U.S. Patent Office. Now, I have just given you the short list. I've described the bare minimum of what counts as filing a patent application. I have talked about what is just barely enough that the U.S. Patent Office will say that you are entitled to a filing date. In the next lecture, I will turn to the question of what is the other list, the one that is not the short list? Why did I bother to talk about a list and call it the short list? It must be that there's a longer list. In the next lecture, we will talk about the long list. Thank you.